Bonnie knows when you plant something, it keeps on giving. Growing from friend to neighbor to community. Generations of gardeners have trusted Bonnie for fresh, healthy vegetable and herb plants. Rely on Bonnie for quality plants, help, and support. Bonnie, gardening with you since 1918. BonniePlants.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and today we have a very special guest. I have to admit that I've been extremely excited about today, and maybe just a little bit nervous because this is someone I very much look up to. I read his column in the New York Times on a weekly basis, and I was very excited to also purchase his new book. Actually, my girlfriend Alyssa was able to get it from me even just before I was able to purchase it for myself. It's Eric Asimov, and his new book is How to Love Wine. It is just a fantastic book. And Eric, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thrilled to be here. Thanks.
So, Eric, please tell us, first of all, why did you think it was important to write a book to instruct people on how to love wine?
Well, it seems intuitive, right? You know, everybody loves wine, and yet I talk to people all the time who are confounded by wine, intimidated by it, made anxious by it, and this is nothing new. The industry knows all about it, and I wondered why this was so. And I mean, it's really a long story, which is the substance of the book, but the short answer is that we convey the idea that people really need to be connoisseurs before they can simply enjoy wine. They have to learn how to describe flavors and aromas. They have to know the grapes that go into wines. They have to know the barrels used to age the wines, the soils where the grapes grow. We send them to wine classes. We send them wine texts. And what's missing in this very hyper-rational approach to wine is developing an emotional connection, which is at the root of enjoyment. Anything we do, we connect to it emotionally. And so this is not a how-to guide, but it tries to reverse that equation, and that's why I called it How to Love Wine.
Right. I mean, I guess I'd imagine you're not the biggest fan of point scores. Right? You don't look at a flower and say, wow, that is a 94-point flower. I really enjoy that flower.
Well, I mean, you can understand why people are drawn to them. There are so many different choices. And, you know, you go into the store and you've got that wall of bottles and you've never heard of them. And half of them are in foreign languages that you can't understand. So points cut through that. But I think very often they communicate erroneous information about wines. They put completely different sorts of wines all on the same universal scale. And so if you're comparing an 85-point wine to the 92-point wine, you're always going to go for the 92-point wine if you're approaching from a position of ignorance. But there are so many situations where that 85-point wine is better than the 92-point wine. And if an ordinary consumer compares the two and they don't prefer the 92-point wine, they think something's wrong with them.
Right. I mean, I can imagine just a very simple, for instance, like a 95-degree day in August in New York, do you want that 100-point Bordeaux or maybe a $10 Prosecco? Which is going to taste better on that day?
You know, there are so many different examples like that. And I mean, that's maybe a little bit more obvious, but, you know, wines that are easygoing, wines that are for everyday, young, fresh, vibrant wines, for some reason on the 100-point scale, they always end up lower than the, you know, the big, robust, tannic, jammy sorts of wines. And maybe this says more about the subjective tastes of the reviewer than it does about an objective ranking of wines.
Well, I mean, I have to agree also with your first point about people feeling like they have to know something about wine in order to enjoy it. It's so funny, you know, in the restaurants I hear all the time, well, I'm no connoisseur, but I think I kind of like this. And you don't hear that about bolognese or, you know, or chicken. Like, no connoisseur, but how do you make your chicken? It's, but for wine, people really feel that they need to know something. Why do you, how did that happen? Why do you think that happened?
Well, you know, I think there's a sense of obligation that comes with it. And partly because it's our culture has used wine as an emblem of civilization. You know, you're an educated, sophisticated person if you know something about wine. And conversely, it also makes fun of people who know something about wine as snobs. You know, so we look at it two ways. But you know, there's another element to that. We've also created this fearful situation, you know, where there are, there's an entire library of books, How Not to Embarrass Yourself, by Choosing a Wine, 10 Things You Need to Know So You Never Make a Mistake. And we've turned wine into this really kind of scary process where, you know, you're subjecting yourself to the judgment of people all around you.
It's true. You know, it's so true. I was at an event last night for the University Settlement. It's a charity event I do every year, and I really believe in their mission and what they do. One of the best things about doing these kind of events is that you get to mingle with the other sommeliers, as well as the guests who've spent quite a bit of money for charity. And one of the sommeliers was telling me a story about anytime she gets a group of guys, and there's clear that one of them is the host, and he is not sure with the wine list. And if he goes up to the bathroom or she could pull him aside, she'll say, hey, choose this wine. This is why you have to choose this wine. And this is what you're going to tell your guests about it. And so this host always feels this insane pressure to impress with his knowledge of wine. And then inevitably, at the end of the meal, he'll always come up to her and be like, thank you. God, you saved me. I looked great. Like, that's amazing.
Well, see, that's why they say great sommeliers are also great psychologists. You know, they can read that emotion.
Yeah. And so one of the things that really struck me in the book, and it's something that I talk about a lot with our servers and the other managers when selling wine, is I really don't like to tell guests what wines taste like. I always feel like if you tell someone it tastes like a specific flavor and they don't see the flavor, then they might feel really self-conscious about that. And in your book, you wrote that you took a really strong stance against tasting notes in general. You said that at their very best, tasting notes were useless, and at their worst, they were pernicious. So where did this come from? Because tasting notes are part of the, you know, when you get into wine, you learn tasting notes. So when did you come to this realization that you hated tasting notes?
Well, I mean, that's exactly the point. Why do you get into tasting notes? I mean, what's the point of them? You know, what other, if we compare cuts of steak, for example, you're saying, do you describe the porterhouse? Well, there, you know, it has this funky, beefy, meaty tang, but the other one has a slightly more refined element. I can't even think of words to describe those sorts of flavors. And yet we've developed this whole vocabulary for describing wines, not just in general terms, but in precise, minute terms. And I've really never seen anybody choose a wine because this one tastes like blackberry and that one tastes like red strawberries. But you know, you feel that you have to talk about wine in that way. And it comes very naturally, to people. It's a learned skill. And, you know, if you look at the history of these things, it's really a shorthand for professionals to keep track of their own impressions about wine. You're tasting dozens of wines at a time, and you're keeping notes for yourself. It's not a way to communicate to vast numbers of people about wine. And if you look closely, it really doesn't tell you anything important about a wine. You can describe a wine in more general terms. You can talk about the structure, the characteristics. Is it more fruity, more savory? Is it heavy-bodied, light-bodied, acidic, tannic? These things are helpful, much more helpful than saying it tastes like guava jam or some kind of tobacco, which is really only a reflection of one's own creative imagination.
And especially, I think, the worst culprits are when you come to these really obscure tastes. I don't like any kind of I'm with you on not liking any specific flavors, but if it's something that's really obscure, I think that just adds to the whole lack of approachability that the wine industry is known for.
Well, there's another reason for it, because where these tasting notes were developed in consumer magazines, where they're talking about dozens, if not hundreds, of wines, and they're all grouped together. And how do you differentiate between those wines? If you were just to talk in general characteristics, the reviewer might get tired of constant repetition. Mm-hmm. But that's what you really see. You have very minute differences in wines that are not reflections of myriad esoteric aromas and flavors, but are really reflections of more general characteristics. And conveying the idea that you need some sort of special personal equipment, you must be a super taster to be able to detect all these fractional differences, I think it's a way of maintaining the authority of the critic and keeping the consumers in their place.
Right. If you say something tastes like blackberry jam with authority and you're so sure of it, that puts you at a different place from...
Oh, you don't see that? Yeah. Oh, well, okay, there must be something wrong.
With me. And so in the book, you also say that you're not a big fan of blind tasting. You think that this is not the most useful thing. However, you do participate in blind tasting at the panel. But the one thing, I have to admit, the day that I went to do a panel was one of my happiest days. I've been... anytime there was an article on Dolcetto or Lambrusco or anything Italian or that we might serve at Anfora, I was like, oh, I wish I was on that panel. But I had done other kind of tasting panels where I was always the last one to finish. They tasted 50 wines and I was trying to keep up and like, I don't know, I keep it. And here we tasted 25 wines and I was the first one. And I was like, oh, wow. Like, oh, we're actually... paying attention to all of the wines. That's what's got, we're going to pay attention to all of them.
I'm conflicted about blind tastings because there are certain instances where it can be educational, where you're trying to train your own palate or your own sense of looking and analyzing wines. But I think the bigger problem is that it conveys the idea that wine is something that can be measured objectively, like toasters or, cars and consumer mm-hmm. reports. You can say this car goes 0 to 60 in 10 seconds, but you can't taste 50 wines before lunch and say that you've nailed each one of those wines, because good wine in particular is always changing and evolving. Talking about wine depends very much on context, and for most people that includes food, the people you're with, the season, your own mood. When you're talking about a blind tasting, the context is the 49 other wines, which is very unnatural, and you're really kind of ignoring important cultural information that can help inform you about a particular wine, because I think really good wines are cultural expressions. They're not just isolated flavors and aromas in a glass, but they convey something about the place where the grapes grew, the people, the heritage of this people, the time and history, and all of this is very important to understanding good wines.
Then why don't you taste not blind when you taste? So the 25 wines, why not say, this is the name of the wine, the grape, the producer, for all of those wines?
Well, you know, this is something that we discuss, but at the same time, the power of the blind tasting is very powerful culturally itself. And, you know, I deal with an institution that has its own ideas. So I'm not really always free to decide how I want to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's something to think about in the future. It's something I think about.
Right. I mean, what we tasted was we did Slovenian wines. And it was a really interesting tasting because there were Slovenian white wines, and there are all different colors of white, different shades, intensities of white, and we didn't know what the grapes were. So I thought that it on a certain level, it really did put those wines on a level playing field. But at the same time, there were wines that were so different from each other that we were that we were comparing. But I found that to be a good and interesting and enlightening way, also just to get the general feel of a region, of a place. What's going on there?
Yeah, you know, as I said, blind tasting can be a very interesting exercise for professionals. It could be a fun game at home. But, it's not the be-all and end-all.
Right.
Sometimes you might learn something after a blind tasting that changes your idea. And, you know, I'm not one who thinks that we're all subject to such a high level of bias that consumers need to be protected from that. I think we're what we're doing is avoiding or keeping ourselves from the sort of knowledge that can help inform our judgments about these wines.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. But we're going to have to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you about a subject that is near and dear to my heart, about wine in restaurants.
You're listening to The Crime Blues by the California Honey Drops on heritageradionetwork.org.
Something, it keeps on giving. Growing from friend to neighbor to community. Generations of gardeners have trusted Bonnie for fresh, healthy vegetable and herb plants. Rely on Bonnie for quality plants, help, and support. Bonnie, gardening with you since 1918. BonniePlants.com.
You know, HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a member-supported nonprofit organization. If you like what you're listening to, go to our website and click that donate button. Become a member and get special discounts, invites, VIP treatment, t-shirts, and more. Support us in our mission to bring you the freshest food content in the nation.
And we're back on In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm here with Eric Asimov, the chief wine critic of the New York Times and author of several books. His most recent one is How to Love Wine, a Memoir and Manifesto. Eric, prior to becoming the chief wine critic for the New York Times, and by the way, I would love to be chief of something one day. What a great title.
You know, I don't have any other wine critics to rule, so it's a little bit... of a mislabeling, but
But it sounds great nonetheless. So prior to becoming the chief wine critic of the New York Times, you founded and wrote the 25 and Under column. You had reviewed restaurants. One of the criticisms that I have, and I think a lot of people in the industry have, of the current restaurant reviewing scene is that a lot of times people don't write about what's going on in the wine list or the beverage program in general. I know there are some reviewers who don't even drink when they go out, or don't, you know, order a cocktail. And you see in New York, restaurants are spending more time and effort with sourcing interesting spirits and wines. And, you know, there are restaurants that employ some of the best bartenders and beverage directors. But this seems like a part of the restaurant reviewing scene that has been kind of left out. Do you agree with my statement on this? And if so, maybe you have some insight as to why, as someone who's been working in journalism for such a long time.
I would say yes and no. I would say that, you know, for me as a consumer, obviously the wine list is very important. But I don't need to know a whole lot about it. You know, it can be covered in a sentence or two, and sometimes is in the Times, at least, in the little box that accompanies the review. I think that the you know, when you're reviewing restaurants, what's singular about a restaurant is the menu, the food, the cooking, the pacing, the service, and wine is part of that, of course. But you can generally, because the wine is not produced there, it's just sort of gathered. You can summarize that gathering process very quickly, and I think sometimes people want more attention paid to it than it really requires.
Some people like me is what you're saying. but sometimes I find that it's just completely ignored, and you know, well,
You want, as a reader, you want to have a sense of what to expect. Is this a creative wine list? Is it a dull list? Is it an all-American list? You know, show some sort of in-depth sense of discovery by the sommelier. How important is it to the restaurant? These are important things. But you know, I remember in the old days they used to cover wine by mentioning two bottles on the list, and that always seemed kind of useless to me.
I agree that doesn't, anyone can have a good bottle on the list, but to store and serve and be able to talk about those wines, I think requires a little bit more effort than just choosing one good bottle. All right. Well, I think we might agree to disagree on this one. So what is your feeling, as to how the restaurant wine scene is right now in New York? Where what's your finger on the pulse of where it is and where it's going?
You would not believe how great it is right now. I mean, you know, when I've been in Manhattan for 30 years, almost 30 years at the New York Times, and you know, back in the mid 80s, you know, wine lists were terrible, and they were still much better than they were 10 years before that. You know, this is, right now, it's the greatest time in history to be a wine lover, because we have such a tremendous diversity of wines available to us, and nowhere is that more true than in New York City, and nowhere in New York is that more true than on wine lists in restaurants. They're just incredible, and part of that is because we have such a passionate cadre of sommeliers who you know, are putting great wines onto the list and care so much about it, and obviously consumers care much more about it too. I mean, I go to restaurants all the time, and you know, you see every table in a restaurant has a bottle of wine on the table at dinner, at least. Yeah. Still working on lunch.
Well, that's true, and you know, there's so many things I want to say. that, you know, as a wine drinking country, we're now, as you know, we drink more wine than anyone else. You see wine on all the tables at the restaurants, as you said, but still people feel this insecurity and they don't just let themselves just truly enjoy it. How do you close that gap? What do we need to do to let people let their guard down and just absolutely love and enjoy and appreciate
wine? Well, you know, that was the reason I wrote the book, because we have this gap between this wonderful diversity of wines available to us and this sense of anxiety and intimidation. First of all, I think that's I'm getting the sense that it's a little bit generational. I think young people feel this anxiety a little bit less. And one of the reasons is because of the democratization of wine via high-speed internet. Mm-hmm. There are so many more opinions about wine available, and people feel a little bit freer to form their own opinion rather than having to compare their ideas with one or two dominant voices. But the other thing is... The people on the internet, sommeliers, I think it's very important, wine merchants, it's very important to watch how we talk about wine. It's very important not to fall into the tasting notes speak and the focus on great wines at the expense of really good daily sorts of wines. And paradoxically, The fact that so many benchmark wines from Bordeaux and Burgundy are now out of the price range of ordinary people has, in a sense, forced people to go exploring and discover different sorts of wines. You know, the wonderful wines from all over Italy, Spain, new wines coming from California here in this country, the wines from Eastern Europe. It's like this whole world of wines that have been made for years, but are now just we're able to discover them and enjoy them in a way that we never were able to before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when with all of my beverage programs, I've sat down with the managers and we've written a mission statement for the beverage programs, and I feel like this is an important thing when you're not relying on just the flavors in the glass. It requires you to know some of the backstory of the wine, and saying that backstory is something that is important. To what extent do you feel that not just the structure of the wine and the way it tastes, but like that actual the backstory, who made it, what's the culture of the wine drinking there? I put a huge importance on that, and I think that comes
well,
through.
I think that's really important, and that's what I mean when I say wine. Good wine is an expression of culture. Mm-hmm. You know, it we want to know where did it come from, who made it, what does it represent about the community and the place it comes from. It's very important though to differentiate between the culture of the wine and the marketing story on the commercial end. The way of selling wine that has been so successful over the years, because the winemakers themselves and the big companies know this, and that's why they try to, construct the pastoral image of wine. So you have to separate what's real about the wine, and what's a marketing construction.
Yeah. So you've been at the New York Times for almost 30 years. You've done a couple of things.
It's crazy, and I'm only 30 years old.
And you're only 30. You started it very young. you taste wine all the time. Taste wine every week. Do you ever get sick of it? Do you ever say, this week I'm? I know you did a couple of beer panels, but it's really been mostly wine.
Yeah, I mean that's I'm not sick of it. I love wine. I love food. I love restaurants. I love cooking, and I love. The way all of these things bring people together. And so it's never just one thing. I mean, I came to wine from a food background. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I love about food and wine is the community it creates around a table. And, it's the whole ensemble that I'm after. I don't want to separate any element of it.
Yeah. Can you tell us just about a recent just time where you were just feeling you're having a great time with wine? Wine just contributed to that ensemble, and it does not have to be in the book you wrote about a really enjoyable formative time you had with a bottle of Beringer White Zinfandel, which was shocking for me to read, but I remember it and understand it. Is there, have you had any experiences
that, like that by the way, was when I was in graduate school many, many years ago?
Right. could you love Beringer White Zinfandel now?
You know, it's been so many years since I've had a bottle. I fear that I would focus now on the confectionery aspects of it, and that it might taste a little bit artificial. Mm-hmm. To me, back then, I just remember having it with a particular meal and just having a great time and thinking, this combination works so well.
So maybe is it possible that actually it's this opposite thing that's happening when you learn so much about wine? And I found this with myself recently that I was tasting wines that were made by larger companies that probably give a lot of joy to a lot of people, but knowing that they were making wines in the millions of bottles, like that took it away from me.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think, your consciousness rises. I can remember many years ago, and certainly as a teenager, sitting around with fast food burgers or whatever and having a great time. But because you enjoyed something at one point in your life doesn't necessarily mean you're going to enjoy it again. I think that would make me sick nowadays.
Right.
And, because of what I know about the practice of raising that food. And, I think wine, we have to think of wine as we think of food. We have a very heightened consciousness about where food comes from, the importance of humanitarian raising of animals, locally grown. And I think we have to think about wine in the same terms, wine that's made industrially, with all sorts of additives and things like that, has to be in a different category from wine that's made essentially as an agricultural product.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, it is crazy that there are so many things that are allowed to be added to wine, but there's no ingredient label on it.
Yeah, and I was very happy to read that Paul Draper at Ridge Vineyards, very important California winery, is now going to list all the ingredients on his label, as does Bonnie Doon and Randall Graham. I think this is great, and I'd like to see more wineries do this.
That's right. Just a little self-promotional plug. We're going to have a Randall Graham, Bonnie Doon dinner at La Picho next Monday. He's always, I think we might be sold out, but it's going to be really, really fun. He's always an interesting guy. He has lots of insight.
Fascinating guy, and he has a lot to say.
He has a lot of great things to say. Wow. Eric, I can't thank you so much. I feel like I could ask you a ton more questions, but we are running low on time. I have to just again give everyone a recommendation to read How to Love Wine. It's a memoir manifesto by Eric Asimov, and I look at your weekly columns as required reading for me and the people in the industry. But I also feel like you're giving a voice to a lot of the sommeliers in the industry and who want to look at wine as something that is more approachable, that is it's there for it's the sole purpose of it should be and is to provide more enjoyment. It's a perk of life, and we shouldn't take it so seriously to the point that it takes away from that. So I can't thank you enough for being on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. And thanks to all of you for listening. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.